Now, Mike Woods, as I mentioned, is Professor of Health Economics at UTS and Adjunct Professor at UC. He's had a long career in economics and public finance in the Commonwealth and also the two territories. He's worked extensively in China on issues of fiscal reform and social insurances reform. He was previously the Under-Treasurer for the ACT and a member of the Australian Statistical Advisory Board. So argue with him at your peril. Mike Woods. Please make him welcome.
Thank you, Virginia. Thank you to the Actuaries Institute for inviting me to come and make this presentation. It's a group that I've had long involvement with in terms of various individuals and companies in this space, because a lot of the work obviously depends on good actuarial understanding. So we're very grateful for the work that you do, and hopefully this will provide you with a slightly different perspective on some of the issues. So having done that, the good news on this topic is that although it's called challenges, is that we are all living longer on average, and that we are living for many more years disability free. So although most of these sessions sort of have the challenges type framework to them, there is actually some underlying good news in this process, that we do get to live longer and healthier lives on average. Okay, so a couple of issues. Now, I'm quoting here from the Intergenerational Report, and it amused me somewhat to see you've got a session coming up very soon on, you know, lies, damn lies, statistics and the IGR. So I'll be very, very interested myself to come along and just see what the perspective is and what the issues are. And of course, all of these things are totally dependent on the assumptions you make and the how clear those assumptions are, etc. So I too can share some war stories in that space of why you need to look at them for their trends, but don't necessarily get too bogged down in the detail. But there are some big issues lurking around there, as we first heard. And, you know, the population ageing, yes, that's no brainer. We've known that for several decades now. But when you actually look at the quantums, and I put up there the quantum change of people aged 85 plus. So I'm not talking about the 60s or the 65s, etc. I'm talking about people heading into frail aged, and you know, plus or minus a bit on the actual numbers, but we're talking nearly 1.5 million extra people 85 plus by the time we get into the 2050s. That is a significant change that will have impacts right through our economy. The dependency ratio, a very, very important ratio, is declining significantly. Currently, 4.5 people in standard working age group per person age 65 plus. Move out to the 2050s, we find that nearly halves, that 2.7 people in that working age group supporting everybody 65 plus. Now, that has wide ramifications. Where's the tax coming from, particularly the income tax side, even though everyone pays GST? But mind you, GST exemptions mean that a lot of the aged, because the exemptions are in health and related areas, they're not paying the same level of GST per head. So there are issues of who's going to fund the services and who's demanding the services. The fiscal impact is increasing. Now, the IGR is a Commonwealth government document. It's not Commonwealth and states. Therefore, it talks about its health expenditure as a percentage of GDP going up from currently 4.2% to 5.5% on health, and aged care nearly doubling from 0.9% to 1.7%. But you think, no, hang on, health's bigger than that in the economy, and you're quite right, that health at the moment, in terms of expenditure, is nearly 10%. It's about 9.8% of GDP in total. And that's because the states, our big expenditure item is health, and particularly public hospitals, but then there's also private health expenditure, your out-of-pockets, that you personally incur. So that is also increasing in that sort of framework. aging is a contributor to rising health costs. Aging gets a bad rap quite often, and people say, well, yeah, health's going up, that's because everyone's getting old. Yes, in part, but only in part. The bigger impacts are, and 80% of the impacts are due to things like the fact that our incomes are rising and therefore our expectations and what we're demanding is rising. That's the big driver. We want more and better healthcare. Technology is always increasing, which is actually quite good. Because we have better drugs, we have better aids and appliances and supports and all the rest of it, but it comes at a cost. And wages are increasing. Now, health and aged care are intensive, personal service-oriented sectors of the economy. And if we have a declining workforce as a proportion of the total population, but rising sectors of the economy that are labour-intensive, something has to give. And to attract more people into this space, obviously then you need to increase wages and increase the acceptability of that sector to people as being their occupation of choice. So there are big workforce issues. How do we find the workforce? And it's not just the professional services, but it's also the caring services, particularly in aged care and other areas, that we're going to need to attract people into that space. Now, Australia is not alone. Think Italy. At the moment, they're playing with the idea of doubling the baby bonus, hoping that somehow that will sort of, you know, fundamentally generate more kids. Well, you know, it's not going to be the big impact that they might be hoping for, because there are an awful lot of other reasons why fertility rates are declining. But think Japan. Japan is actually, as a country, now in a declining population mode. It peaked in 2008 at somewhere about 128 million. It's now already a million less 8 years on. Its workforce peaked in the late 90s and is now 10 million people less in the workforce than what it was back then. So Japan is already in the downward side. It will continue to reduce as a population size country, and even more significantly reduce as a workforce to generate returns, which gives me an opportunity to plug the importance of productivity, that if we don't grow productivity in our economy, we can't afford to pay for what we're trying to achieve. But it has profound implications for this sort of actuarial industry. You know, we're talking retirement incomes, and we've got Cebus here talking to us in a minute. Drawdown of wealth. We have to think of wealth as a life cycle issue, not a let's accumulate and then use the taxpayer to fund our aged care services and let's, you know, sort of have a bequest to all the kids for all of our hard-earned work. It can't work like that into the future. Paying for public services, you know, where's the tax coming from? How can we make these services more efficient? Workforce supply, where are we going to get that from? The changes in consumption, so the nature of the economy is going to change as consumption moves to reflect this older population. Issues of accommodation are going to significantly change. So, you know, it is quite a profound impact that we do need to look to, and the actuarial skills are going to be desperately needed across quite a range of areas. So I just want to go through some of the aged care reforms briefly. And it kicked off with the Productivity Commission's 2011 report on caring for older Australians, and I was the presiding commissioner on that, so I'm vaguely familiar with what we're on about. But the top three things there I just want to emphasise is that the whole trend in the future will be to give greater empowerment to older people. So the aim of the Productivity Commission's report was to promote independence and well-being and wellness, to ensure that services were person-centred, that can actually, rather than having the old people fit the programs that are on offer, have the services delivered to meet the needs of the frail elderly as they emerge and as they change. And it's not a linear progression, by the way. So we do need a range of varying services. And to be consumer-directed, people can choose what of those services they want to consume from whom and how. And I put in there, because it was in our report and got quite a mix of reactions, about the importance of ensuring that people have a choice to die well, that is a very important part of this whole process. You know, we are all going to die, but it's the quality of our death that is something that we do need to be very conscious of. Now, I've thrown up this, NACA is the, and I won't touch the microphone again, I hope, the National Aged Care Alliance, which is a body that has come together under the leadership of the Council of the Aging, COTA, but it includes the unions, the service providers, the consumers, and the workforce. And they came up with a range of strategic objectives which mirror where the Productivity Commission report headed. Now, I've got all this in detail on the slide so that you can follow it all up later. I don't need to go through laboriously all of the bits. I just want to pick out some of the highlights. But they also importantly talked about some complementary reforms in retirement income, in accommodation, issues of urban design and the like. So what was the Productivity Commission proposing? In particular, well, one was to actually navigate the system. I don't know if ever you've tried to navigate the system for your elderly parents or friends or colleagues, but it is a bit of a minefield and we do need to improve that. And happily, these changes are being made. Choosing care at home if desired, so rather than go into residential care, a lot more care being delivered to people at home to stay in the community, be relevant, important, significant and comfortable in their own space for as long as possible. Importantly, contribute to the costs of care. Some of the issues I was trying to set up earlier is that we can no longer just assume that once you get into your elderly phase, somehow the taxpayer will magically pay for all of your services, and that if you do have some income or wealth yourself, we were strongly proposing, and governments are picking up, that you will need to make a contribution to those costs. And that includes accessing the wealth embedded in the home. It might be controversial, but is significant. So reforms are going along on three phases. And the first point I want to make, Virginia mentioned before about, well, things may change on the 2nd of July. Very, very pleasingly in aged care, it is bipartisan reform. And a lot of work has been done with both sides of politics to ensure that they have a common perspective on where this is happening. So the politics are largely taken out of it, and there is some very good work being done through the National Aged Care Alliance, but through other parties, including my current roles, to ensure that there is common view as to where we're heading, because it creates certainty, it creates ability to invest, it creates planning opportunities. In this first phase, community-based care has been expanded, and the old days of you had your bond that you paid to go into residential care largely was determined by how much did you sell your house for was the first question you got asked when you went in. Okay, therefore your bond is X. All of that's now been taken out of the system, and accommodation reflects the value of that accommodation, and it is known beforehand, and you can pay on a rental basis rather than on a bond basis. So they're significant changes. Phase two is happening, and we're into consumer-directed care, so a lot more work is being done there. And I mentioned there restorative care, importantly, because as I said, this isn't necessarily a linear process in terms of your ageing. The people can have temporary setbacks, but if we actually invest a bit, they can recover some or all of their previous functionality and capacity to live strong and effective lives in their frail aged years. We just need to invest a little bit and help them do that. And, of course, that's cost effective. Phase three is coming up, which in particular there'll be a five-year review of progress, but that the home care package funding will follow the consumer, i.e. they have not only the ability to have some consumer-directed care, making some choices within a menu, but they actually have control over the funds and they can choose who the provider is and what will happen with that money. And if they don't like it, they can go to a different provider. And that brings in some very powerful incentives. I did say I was from the Productivity Commission earlier, and of course the market is where a lot of those forces come from. Those are the terms of review for the 2016 aged care review that it will happen later this year. Do watch that space if you're interested here, because that will then work out if there's some need for a bit of tweaking and refining in that space. Now, there are a number of outstanding issues, and I just want to spend a couple of minutes looking at those. They are important. One is that on the residential care side, we do need to also remove the supply side limits and therefore empower people to choose which facility they go to, whether they stay there, whether they move to somewhere else. Providers will have to compete for the consumer rather than the consumer having to find a vacant space amongst one of the providers. And it just changes totally the dynamics in this industry, and it is fundamental to getting reforms. But ultimately, something that the Productivity Commission, or I and my team, were playing with is, what happens if we get rid of the idea of aged care as such? Let's normalise as much of the market as we can, so that we have individuals or their carers or their agents making consumer choices, that care is delivered in whatever accommodation it is that they decide is what they can afford to pay and what they want to live in, with safety nets for all of those who can't. Reposition the current nursing homes as sort of a multiple care facility for a whole range of different uses. And therefore get back to what's the fundamental role of government. One is an equity issue, to provide targeted consumer subsidies and support for those in need. And the second is to overcome market failures, which is have accreditation where that's needed to ensure that the services are appropriate, and to ensure that there is information that is symmetrical, that consumers know as much as producers, and to, in things like rural and remote, and that provide subsidies to providers. So they're the issues there, which lead us to look at some of the matters that your industry is going to need to contribute to. So a whole range of care issues. We're going to need to understand the demographics and costs. In terms of subsidies, there's an awful lot of modelling that has to happen in that space. Workforce recruitment, assessing future demand. Accommodation, again, a demand sort of issue. Adequacy of retirement income, massive issue. Pensions, super, life insurance, insurance bonds, you know, that whole space. People have got to be able to afford to live through those years as much as have services provided to them. And then there's an issue of care insurance. Can a market develop? Question one. And can it be done without government underwriting? Question two. And the Productivity Commission report's useful reading in that space. Now, according to my report, I've got 2 minutes left. I just want to change tack. And I'm doing this partly because one of your members had known of this report that we did at the Productivity Commission and said it'd be really good to just sort of change the focus and allow members to understand a slightly different topic. So in 2 minutes, deep and persistent disadvantage. It's a significant report. It's all on the PC website. Disadvantage is multidimensional. A lot of people move in and out of disadvantage over their lifetime. A whole lot of life events can make can trigger that change, whether it's health or unemployment or criminal justice system or separation or whatever it is. There is some intergenerational transfer of disadvantage, not all, but some. And building resilience, the resilience we heard about in the first session, that starts early and is fundamental. We hear a lot about income poverty, but there's an awful lot more to disadvantage than income poverty. There's financial poverty, i.e. you don't only have income to draw on, but you have no wealth to act as a backup. Deprivation is very fundamental. Can you actually afford the fundamentals of life? And social exclusion, even more pervasive and more difficult. Deep disadvantage is persistent. So that the bottom two shades there, the hatched and the black there. So disadvantage itself will change depending on economic circumstance, you know, rising economy, lifts all boats, et cetera, and more people get employed and poverty reduces. But deep and persistent disadvantage sits down the bottom of our society, and I shouldn't use the word bottom, but sits in our society and is ongoing. And there's some churn. Some people move in and out of disadvantage within a year or two, but there are other households that are in disadvantage for, you know, 5, 6, 10+ years. And the final slide, why care about disadvantage? Well, partly through humanitarian reasons. There are strong personal costs to disadvantage. Lower standards of living, poorer quality of life, poorer health, joblessness, isolation, addiction, all of those issues fit in that space, although not all addicts obviously are disadvantaged, but there is strong commonality in some of that. The productive capacity of the economy is lower. That's something we should also worry about. So we're not actually making the best use of the workforce or the potential workforce that we have, and therefore we also have lower output per head of population. And the public costs are high. And every time we do tax transfers to target those in need, of course, it's not only the transfer, but it's the deadweight loss incurred in taxation. And the costs and resources, the manpower, the person power used in welfare services could easily and better be directed in everywhere else. And, of course, lower consumption demand leads to lower economic growth. So, thank you.